If you haven't heard about this yet, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel wants you to be a part of the news. We're hosting a new event called JS Talks. The event connects our readers to our sources. For the first JS Talks, we'll hear from Milwaukee Bucks leadership and architects about the new arena. We'll have more on the event later in today's show. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Mike Grassel is in his 40s and has progressive dementia. On Wednesday nights, he attends art therapy class with his wife, Julie, at the Donna Lexa Art Center. The center's mission is to promote creativity, dignity, and community for people with special needs through art. Mike is a beloved member of the community at the center. Here's reporter Crocker Stevenson talking to producer Michael Meidenbauer about this story.
So, Crocker, your story begins with the meeting of Mike and Julie Grassel. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah, they were freshmen at UWM in the 1980s. They met on the first day of school in psychology class. Julie remembers Mike coming down the steps of the auditorium that they were in and plopping down next to her. And within a few months, they knew that they were going to spend the rest of their lives together. They were committed to each other. But at the beginning of their sophomore year or a little ways into their sophomore year, Mike was in a terrible car accident. His mom was driving him to work, and a car coming towards them lost its wheel. The wheel went through the windshield of his car and hit him in the head. He was unconscious for a week. When he came to, he didn't even recognize Julie. He was paralyzed on the left side of his body. He had suffered this terrible brain injury. He couldn't remember anything of his past. But she stayed with him through his recovery. And eventually he was able to return to school, finished. The two of them got married, had two kids, and have lived happily ever after. Though when Mike was 43, he began to forget stuff. He would get lost. He would have trouble figuring things out at work. And Julie noticed this too, and he was diagnosed with early onset Alzheimer's. It was eventually changed to a progressive dementia, but the outcome is the same. He is losing his memory.
And how are they taking it? What's their outlook like?
You know, you would think that someone as young as Mike, he was 43, would despair at this. I mean, his two children. They're an amazing couple, and Julie's interest is just making sure that Mike's life is as rich and as enjoyable and full of joy as possible. And so they've become very active in the Alzheimer's Association, and they socialize with other people with dementia, and they get together for what they call a memory cafe. They get together and talk and support each other. They go to baseball games. They have a club they call the Purple Canoe Club, and they support each other. Another thing that Mike has found, though, that has kind of changed his life, it's just something he just never contemplated doing, and that is art. He loves it. So he was sad when he had to cut back on his job. He was a manager at Walgreens, and he still works at Walgreens about 12 hours a week, but he stocks shelves, and he didn't see himself doing that. But Julie gave him a briefcase, which he's filled with markers, crayons, paints, and he's become this. He's got a business card with some of his artwork on it, and he is involved in creating art.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it really is. It's kind of a celebration for him. There are several programs around in which art or music is used to help engage people with dementia in their lives and in thinking and creativity. And one of the programs that is offered is in Waukesha, in the city of Waukesha. It's called the Don Alexa Art Center. They offer classes to people with cognitive disabilities, all kinds of cognitive disabilities. And my story is about a Wednesday night at Don Alexa with Mike, who is sort of like the life of the party. He comes in, he puts his iPhone on the middle of the table and turns on the music and dances with people, and it is a celebration.
Right. And their story is one of many of people affected by Alzheimer's, and that's going to be a growing story, isn't it?
Well, beginning in January, people, baby boomers, began to turn 70 at a rate of 10,000 a day. And right now there are about 5 million people in the United States with Alzheimer's. That number should triple by or more in the coming years, and unless we figure out how to, if not cure, then at least control Alzheimer's. And of those people, normally we think of Alzheimer's as a disease of the elderly, but of the 5 million people with Alzheimer's right now, about 20,000 of them are like Mike. They have early onset dementias. And the key for not just young people with Alzheimer's, but also for everyone, is to continue to be alive and to remain active and creative. It's important for a lot of reasons that you tell that story, because I think we look at Alzheimer's the way we once looked at cancer, that it's a death sentence, and that money that is put towards research is wasted because there's nothing we can do about it. But the truth is, people are living with Alzheimer's and are figuring out ways to enrich and enlarge their lives after being diagnosed, and it's important for people to hear Mike's message in particular, which is a message of hope. In virtually all of Mike's drawings and paintings, he adds a rainbow in some spot, and that rainbow, the meaning of that rainbow is hope. It is a symbol of hope, and that is his message: is that that despair is not the option; that hope is the option.
Crocker's story is running in today's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Pick up a copy or read it online at jsonline.com. Many questions linger about the design and impact of the proposed Milwaukee Bucks Arena and its related developments. This week, the Journal Sentinel hosts a public discussion about the arena's design and development. We're inviting the public to participate in a panel discussion with the Bucks president, the building's architects, and guest critics. The event takes place Thursday at 6 p.m. at Turner Hall and is the first in a series of JS Talks that aims to bring newsmakers, reporters, editors, and readers together with music, drinks, socializing, and discussion. Journal Sentinel business reporter Tom Dakin and art and architecture critic Mary Louise Schumacher will host the event. Mary Louise talks with Allison Sherwood about the discussion.
Mary Louise, so tell me more about this event. What is it?
Well, it's the very first in a series of what we hope will be a series called JS Talks. And the way we're kind of thinking about this, the newsroom, is it's basically doing journalism live. So it's taking what we do every day for the newspaper and for our website and creating a live event for our audiences and our readers. So in this case, our first talk is going to be about the Milwaukee Bucks Arena. So, you know, this is one of the more critical issues going on in our city today. The city of Milwaukee is really being transformed right now by a lot of development, a lot of big projects across the urban landscape. But nothing will have the impact that this new downtown arena will have, both just because of the sheer size of this project, but also because of the potential for development around it. So what we've decided to do is really bring the people who are most critical to this project into the space at Turner Hall, and that includes the Bucks president, Peter Fagan, the lead architect on the project, which is Brad Clark from Populous Architects based in Kansas City, and then Greg Ewan, who is the local architect with Epstein Ewan, as well as an outside architecture critic, Stephen Chung, who is the host of a PBS show about architecture. And, you know, we'll probably share new information at this event just like we would in a news story. So people who come will actually learn new things about this project. And then we'll ask some really hard questions and hopefully actually make some news, learn new things about where this project is headed.
You're trying to draw in the community as well.
Yeah.
There'll be a cash bar and
right.
hopefully get some conversations going as well.
Yeah, I mean, our hope is that, you know, I mean, a lot of folks do panel discussions around town, and we really don't want to have the usual panel discussion. So first and foremost, this will not be a formal event. It will be fun and social. So we're really hoping people will just come meet other people, have a drink, meet some of these really critical people to the project face to face, have a chance to talk to them in person. And it's also a chance for us as journalists to kind of, you know, talk to the people who are directly experiencing the news we're writing about. So it's a chance for us to hear, you know, directly from our readers what they're thinking about, what their questions are. And there will be lots of opportunities for them before the event and actually during the event to be part of the conversation by submitting questions through social media channels and particularly Twitter using the hashtag JSTalks.
And how did this come about?
Well, you know, journalism has been doing this actually for a very long time. I mean, it's not uncommon to hear that 100 years ago, newspapers would use kind of their convening authority to bring people together around really important issues and to have events that were really about setting the agenda in a city rather than simply reacting to the news. So this is a way for us as an organization to really identify some critical issues that weren't more public discourse. So this sort of thing has been happening for a while. And in recent years, you see kind of a flourishing of these forums. So The New Yorker has the New Yorker Festival. They've been doing that since, I think, 2009 or so. And they bring great writers into New York and great editors, and they have great conversations. Newspapers like the Dallas Morning News has an event called the Festival of Ideas, and it's a week-long event where they have really important conversations. So it's not that new. And we do some similar things, but this is sort of a new push for us in this direction of live journalism. And it's just an extension, I think, of our values in recent years of engaging our audiences. I mean, there are so many tools through social media that allow us to kind of connect more directly with our readers. And I think that's really made us realize how valuable that is to us as journalists and how important that is for us to kind of find other ways to explore. So this is just another way for us to do that kind of in person.
As the art and architecture critic, what are you personally most looking forward to discussing at this event?
Well, I'll be honest with you. So I'm going to be moderating the discussion along with Tom Dagan. So Tom will probably have a lot of questions about the development that is happening around this project. He's a business reporter who focuses on commercial real estate and development. From my perspective, I'd really like to see the design discussion elevated. I don't think there's been enough discussion about how this building is going to impact the urban landscape. There are aspects of it that I think are really bold and great, but it is not a great building yet. It really does need some additional work, I think, and I have yet to talk to a single architect or designer in this city who thinks it's a great building, who doesn't have some reservations about some of the details. So this is a chance for us to really focus on the design and kind of push the owners and the architects to kind of pay attention to design a little bit more.
Catch the JS Talks event Thursday, May 5th at 6 p.m. at Turner Hall. For more information on the event, visit jsonline.com/jstalks. Eugene Kane, a former columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, nearly died last Christmas after suffering a diabetic seizure and stroke on a highway near Washington, D.C. He's telling his story now to alert other people to the dangers of the disease.
It was Christmas Day. I'm traveling. I had an East Coast vacation where I spent some days in Philadelphia, my hometown, rented a car, was on my way to the Washington, D.C. area to visit my sister. Along the way, I became kind of disoriented and sleepy, not really knowing what was happening to me. So I pulled over to the side of the road, and essentially I woke up something like 3 weeks later in a hospital after being in intensive care. What happened was, according to what people have told me, I was experiencing a diabetic seizure, which sent me into a diabetic coma, which basically led to a mini stroke that I had, which is amazing to me because I'd never been diagnosed as a diabetic before. Although since then, I have now, thinking back, I do recognize there were some warning signs that month before it happened, and that led to me basically, like I say, being discovered on the side of the road by this highway worker who came upon me and basically managed to contact my sister to tell her, well, I'm here with your brother and he doesn't seem to be doing real well. And looking back on it, it's just amazing to me that this stranger basically encountered me, a good Samaritan, you could call him an angel basically in my mind, who came and stayed with me on Christmas Day to make sure that I was okay. And we never got his name, and I think I mentioned in the essay, I've never really figured out who he was. But I'm eternally grateful for him. I think to have high sugar, sometimes people tell you it's if it gets above 150 or 200, according to what I've learned, the night in the emergency room, my sugar level was close to 1,100. And I had doctors at the hospital who came to see me after visiting me in intensive care when I was basically on life support, who expressed to me that they were shocked that I had managed to survive that. So I decided to write about it mainly because learning through my education, I found, you know, it disproportionately impacts on African Americans, and I found also Latino Americans, people from Hispanic origins also have the same problems. It runs in families. It's such a prevalent disease in America, the seventh leading cause of death, I've found. I think what really brought my attention about writing was just recently I had, in the last month or so, a very popular rapper, Fife Dawg from A Tribe Called Quest, who I wasn't really a big fan of, but I have younger relatives who were. His story came out, and he had been diabetic for a long time. Since then, Doug Banks, who is a popular morning radio host, he died from this. Larry Holmes, a famous boxer in Philly, he basically recently discovered a few years ago he had it. Patti LaBelle, who is one of my all-time favorite singers, has it. I think the theme I was using in my essay is a silent, there are so many diseases that are considered a silent killer because you might not even know you have them, but there's enough warning signs in your own family history and just in your own family lifestyle that could cause you that if you haven't checked yourself for diabetes with a physician, you probably should do it. And in my case, things like becoming overweight, becoming very sedentary, which I admit I was, and really it's the family history. If you have if you have people in your immediate family who have diabetes, you should regularly be checked with diabetes.
Eugene wrote about his experience for this week's Crossroads section. His column is also available at jsonline.com/opinion. We wish Eugene all of the best as he continues on his journey. What does it take to cover the NFL draft? For Bob McGinn, covering the draft means researching 400 different players. McGinn talked to fellow beat writer Michael Cohen about Michael's first experience covering the draft.
So, Mike, I've covered a few of these, but you've covered your first one here tonight.
Yeah.
At 1265 Lombardi Avenue, how was the first NFL draft?
It was definitely interesting. You know, of course, I followed the draft, you know, growing up a sports fan and growing up a Giants fan living in Connecticut. So I followed it throughout the years when I was a kid. But this was the first year that I really cared enough to get into it in terms of looking at the prospects, looking at different scenarios, who might be where. And obviously the first time I was around you as you worked on your draft series, so I saw how that comes together. And it was really a unique prospect process, I should say, because you can go crazy with this, and you can also just sort of be on the periphery. There's guys that get really, really into it, you know, the way that you do and the effort you put into it. And I sort of was in the middle. I didn't go nuts with it, but I did a lot of research on these guys, enough to do, you know, my draft responsibilities. And I think it's kind of fun, you know. I don't know. I thought it was cool to look at these guys, to actually think about, you know, their different skill sets and their body types and think who might fit where. And I didn't talk to scouts. I did just more of eye test kind of stuff. But I thought it was cool.
Good. Yeah.
How did you like it right away when you started doing this, or did it take you a few years to really recognize the quote-unquote fun element of it?
Well, I saw it as a way to learn the league, you know. The more time I spend now, it would just help me for the next 11 months that I would know something about. I try to learn about 400 players, and by learning about it, hopefully I can retain it. And after talking to all these scouts, I should know something about that when I'm doing my scouting report in the middle of October on the Buccaneers' safeties. I'll remember what they ran and what their strength is. And so by hitting it hard this time of year, it helped me with my whole job. So that's what I really liked about it.
So when you go through the process and you learn about particular guys, I imagine it's kind of unique, too, to see them on tape and say, oh, this is exactly what the scout was talking about. Or, hey, this kid really improved at this because this was one of his knocks in college. Do you see a little bit of that? Or when you watch tape of guys, do you immediately think to quotes that stick out in your head?
You know, I see it like this. I don't really think anybody really cares what I think about a player. And I don't think anybody...
I'll disagree with that.
But anybody who's like me, I've never scouted or coached a day in my life. A lot of people on TV have never scouted or coached a day in their life. I don't really care what they say. So I'm just subservient to all the experts who do coach, who do scout. And I just let them tell the story. I'm just trying to be an information gatherer, trying to arrive at a consensus, which is impossible, but I sure try by talking to enough people. To me, if you look at the polls in this series, the polls tell it all. People ought to pay more attention to the polls. This is the pulse of the league. How else are you going to get it? You're going to get a guy on TV who, whatever his background is, looks at some tape and just makes these opinions? Or are you going to look at an unbiased poll from all these people? I don't know. So that's just where I'm coming from, Mike.
That audio comes to us from our Packers podcast. You can catch the full thing on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, and online at jsonline.com. And that does it for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. If you're interested in listening to more of our podcasts, you can subscribe to them through iTunes and Stitcher Radio as well. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Tune in next week for more behind-the-scenes information from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.